to talk about what we need to talk about. And we appreciate your time and coming in and hanging out with us all day, dude.
Yeah, no, and obviously we appreciate the invite. And as a new company with Vector Industries, just being able to work with you guys and, you know, get products, show it off, and get people excited about what we're doing at Vector through the, you know, big tech family.
For sure. For sure. And you're an avid listener. He's multiple times today. He's brought up, oh, an episode
42.
So the good thing is being, you know, the owner of the company and the face of the company and doing a lot of the driving around and the sales and being willing to get in a truck and show up anywhere at any time for a range day or a event or that kind of stuff to really be able to show people Vector and what we need to do. There are some hours, you know, we left Wednesday last week. We drove 12 hours from St. Louis, Missouri, House Springs, where Vector's based out of. We ended up at TTPOA. We did TTPOA's conference and, you know, competition out there for a couple days. We've hit 10 or 15 different things here now. We're here today. I'll be back here Sunday. I got to go to Louisiana.
I'm sorry.
Saturday. I got to go to Louisiana for a couple meetings. And then I got to go back to Louisiana on Monday for a meeting. Then I'll be home, you know, after a two-week trip. And then I got to go to Oklahoma City. And then I got to go back up to Michigan. And, I mean, I had to stop Monday morning and get my oil changed in my truck for the first time because I'm at 14,000 miles in 2 months.
It's about time. 10,000, every 10,000.
It said I had 17% oil life left. So I was like, all right, that's good enough for me. About time.
That's fantastic. Awesome. You want to do the...
Yeah. So, welcome. Thank you for watching the Big Tech's Ordnance Podcast. I'm Ike. We have Chris, Justin, and we have Dave from Vector Arms. Is it Vector Arms or
Vector Industries?
Industries. Industries. I messed that up. Vector Industries. But we appreciate you watching. And Dave, thanks for coming down and talking with us.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Nice. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
But tell us, go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of growing up and in the industry and what all you've been a part of and involved with and kind of what's going on behind the scenes.
So grew up in the northwest suburbs of Chicago and I think like 8 years. I'm always wrong on dates because of COVID and other things and years and things all mixed together. But I think like 8 years ago, we were doing like automotive car jewelry machining for old school muscle cars. So like billet dashes, billet sill plates, billet inserts for billet knobs for that kind of stuff. And after Sandy Hook, the shop just took a couple gun orders, a couple gun parts, started making gun parts. And, you know, 8 years later, it was DRG Manufacturing and White Label Armory back then. In March, I sold it to my sisters. They're running it. It's a Outer Wild Outpost and Outer Wild Manufacturing now. And we systematically just went through over like a 5-year period of building fully automated robotic cells for the parts in the industry that were, I don't want to say expensive, but were hard to get and were the first things to go away when things happened.
Yeah.
So we build, you know, 10,000 bolt carrier groups a month fully robotically. We assemble a bolt every 8 seconds fully robotically, you know, with a pick and place rotary transfer type machine. We're the only ones in the industry that do that. I mean, it runs 4,000 a shift. Jeez. With one operator. So, but the process is what really drives me and what matters to me. And being able to do the, you know, 4,000 handguards a month, 2,000-3,000 billet sets a month, and 6,000 or 8,000 barrels a month we can do. So we gun drill, ream, and rifle our own barrels and our blanks in house. And then we have a fully robotic cell that profiles and chambers. Hmm. So we can run a barrel every 3 minutes.
Wow.
You know, and we were talking a little bit before the podcast and everything about why robots, why this, why that, consistency. And it's hard to find a person to stand in front of a machine and open the door and close the door and load the thing every 3 minutes. You know, if you're sitting there doing it, it's the process matters. So you never make a bad part twice. And that's built into our process a lot, especially automation and that kind of stuff. We truly walk away. Like right now, we're running one shift of labor and two shifts fully automated. They walk away from that kind of stuff 16 hours a day. So if you want a part that's perfect, your process better be rock solid.
Yeah.
So a lot of in-process inspection, a lot of QC and certain things built into that process to make sure that the critical dimensions of the things that truly, truly matter are checked unattended while no one's there. And either the machine, you know, will text message you, hey, I got a problem, or it'll stop.
The machines are taking over. They're texting us now.
Yeah. So the cell will automate you and say, hey, change my diaper. I got a problem. But if it breaks,
do they do their own like tool changes and everything too? Or
so a lot of the mills and all that kind of stuff will change, tool change itself. We're running redundant tooling in the lathes where it'll automatically, we know that tool will make the same size hole and the same size thing for 150 parts, right? Well, at 167 parts, it breaks. So we never want a broken tool. So at 150 parts, the computer goes in, it runs a macro. It says, okay, I'm at 150 parts. I've cut this many parts or inches or however we do it for tool life. And it'll say, pull up the redundant tool number one. And it'll pull up that same tool in another tool holder and run it for the next 150 parts. So being able to build that process into it, you get stability and you get the same thing every time. And doing things back to the old school ways where, like a hole, you don't just drive in a drill through a hole. You spot it, you spot it, you drill it, and then you ream it. So it's three tool changes instead of one tool change. You can get some dreamers, you can get some compound tools, you can do some other things to get it back to one tool. But the process and the way that you get a perfectly sized 250 takedown pinhole every time doesn't change. So if you push too hard on it, or if you do it while it's not solid, if you do it while it's not this, mattering how you cut things, you'll bend your ears out, you bend your ears in. The hole is straight, but once you put a rod through it as a pivot pin, now that is slightly, you know, if one hole is slightly off or the ears are slightly bent because your fixturing's wrong or that kind of stuff, your pivot pins don't go through perfectly. So just a lot of the really cool little things on how to make the same part the same way every time. And we nerded out on process. And then hired just crazy guys that could implement the crazy process.
I still want to go up there one of these days.
Anytime.
And check it out, dude. Yeah.
I've seen the videos. Like, y'all did a pretty cool YouTube video a couple years ago.
Yeah.
That, like, showed, like, all the robots and stuff.
Yeah, Mr. Guns and Gear came through, and we delved into, like, really, really nerdy stuff on that. Like, our bulk carrier groups, they're the only ones in the industry right now that grind the OD first. Everybody grinds the OD because it's a cheap grinding process, but nobody really grinds the three IDs. So grabbing the OD in a self-centering chuck, holding on the OD, the bulk carrier group, on that ground surfaces after heat treat, so it's qualified now, and then going in and grinding all three IDs to a six surface finish where they're just beautiful. And it fixes concentricity. Like, honing won't fix concentricity. The hone's going to follow the hole.
Oh, yeah.
You'll get size, but you won't get concentricity fixed. So now on a bolt, you have three different steps where you have to be perfectly back and forth concentric. We grind all of our bolts. The way we, for a bolt, you know, will, the grinding machine will touch off on the face of the bolt so that we can control our head spacing on the bolt perfectly within a tenth. So knowing that the grind stock we leave on the back of the logs, we touch the face of the bolt, so we know that our 154 dimension's perfect every time. So our consistency and our lockups and all that kind of stuff drives our accuracy.
Hi, I'm Chris from Big Tex
Ordnance, and I'm Ian from Big Tex
Ordnance. And today we've got the weekly update. So first off, from Voltor is the classic Murr upper receivers, right? So we've got them in foliage green, black, standard black. Those were my picks. What do you got over there?
For all the wheel gun enthusiasts out there, we've started carrying some Safariland Comp 3 and Comp 2 speed loaders for J frames and K frames. So if you guys need a good speed loader for all of your revolver needs, we got some. We have the new Streamlight Wedge XT also. These come in black and FDE. Great little task light. You know, drop your keys underneath the couch. You're looking for your burrito. Good little option from Streamlight. Comes with a little lanyard on it as well.
Solid price point on those. I'll have to reference the price point on those.
USB-C but. Rechargeable, and it has a deep carry pocket clip on it.
Yeah, so option.
Looks great.
Coming up, there's a bunch of classes. We got Paradox training. Gonna be across the street at the range. Doing that the 27th, not this weekend, but next weekend. Anyway, lots of training events coming up. We just also posted the Sons of Liberty.
Oh, yeah, the Armors
class. Armors class in May. It's up on the website. Anyway, thanks for watching.
Be safe.
Finger guns.
So.
That stuff just blows my mind that you can,
yeah,
like you can do that without even anybody. Like I understand that robots are smart, and the dudes programming them to do what they do, that it just blows my mind.
But how do you remove the material? How and what process do you remove the material? Like, let's look at a forged upper. It bananas and it twists. So there's certain things on a forged upper and the way you machine it and the way that you remove that material from that thing. And also you have to, in the middle of a forged upper process, you have to take it out of the fixturing. You have to let it do that, like twist and stuff, put it back in and then fix a couple things or you'll never truly meet the mil spec. The upper is way harder to make than a lower.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Because it's, look at a forged upper. I mean, it's thin walled.
Yeah, you got a big
You're hole. Removing... 90-something percent. I mean, it's an aerospace part at that point. You're removing 90% of it, and your datums and your concentricity is based off of the center of your bore. You have two different sized bores in there if you're running a true mil-spec. You know, you're running a 999 for the first inch 30, I think, and then the back end you're running 106, you know, on the high side of the print. So lining up those two circular datums, lining those two bores up perfectly, and then doing everything else to it and getting into the GD&T in the way that the center of your bore matches to the thickness of your lugs in theoretical space, how you finish and how you remove that material and how you let it flex, it'll drive people nuts for 7 months and they'll never make a good part because they're missing one part of the operation that you just can't cheat.
That's crazy.
So welcome to my brain.
Yeah, I know. You're just like spitting off dimensions and
good luck sleeping.
Yeah. So we got Justin here today kind of filling in for Mr. Ian.
But you're the numbers nerd when it comes to the gun stuff though, too. When you've delved into the barrels.
Yeah, I like to get into the, weeds a little bit.
Yeah,
but not too much.
Yeah,
yeah. So
there's like a healthy level.
Hammer forged versus chrome lined versus 4140 versus 4150 versus 416R versus, you know.
Why are barrels? So this comes from a standpoint of what we've seen come through and what we've interacted. I won't speak of certain manufacturers. But it seems like one of the hardest parts to get consistently correct are barrels. What is it about barrels that are so freaking difficult to manufacture? I come from this, like, I make emails. I run emails and neurons for a living. I don't do manufacturing. So, like, so what makes barrels so hard?
There's two ways. So, let's go to the blank. Okay, so let's start with a blank. You have a... we'll talk about 16-inch barrels, right? So you have a 17-inch piece of material. You're now gun drilling reaming and rifling a 22 caliber hole through it for a 5.56. And people will start with an inch diameter material. They'll start with an inch 06, you know, that kind of inch 1.06, you know, dimension, that kind of stuff. Where your chamber is on a barrel is like 980. Okay. So way we run our barrels is we run two separate chamfers. We'll run a big chamfer on the right side, and we'll run a small chamfer on the left side, and we'll put a mark on our barrel blank on the right side. So we gun drill, pull ream, and pull button. All we gun drill through the chamber side. We pull ream through the chamber side. And we rifle through the chamber side. So everything gets tracked through that side. Because you have 10 thou or, yeah, like 10 or 15 thou of material left to get back to concentricity to clean up all the way around. Where on the muzzle side, you can have 60, 70 thou of run out and it still clean up in a machine. But now that you've made, like, we'll run barrel blanks and over 17 inches, we'll have four thou TIR, not 70. So, I mean, what
is TIR?
Oh, God.
Another rabbit hole.
Yeah, so you put it on centers, and you want to make sure that you're straight. So the straighter you are, is your TIR is better.
Gotcha.
So you don't want, I know you can't really see it, but, I mean, think of a pencil and just rotating your hands back and forth and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You have a cylinder, and you have either a hole drilled through it like this, or you're straight. Straighter the better.
Yeah, it's kind of like a pool cue, I guess. You know, you roll it on the
yep
on the table and see,
yeah, how flat it rolls, yeah, or whether it flops.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So you want a straightness equals accuracy. You want a really good straight hole. Where that straight hole is located within your blank, you can fix in the next operation, mattering how you do it. So now that you have a good rifled, reamed, and gun-drilled blank, all of our stuff goes out for stress relief. So we stress relieve it all, we get it back, and then we'll profile it. Now there's two ways to profile it. So you can say my hole's really accurate to the OD. So if you're a job shop, and if you're a guy not really doing barrel manufacturing as a like hardcore thing, you're probably just going to chuck it in your lathe, grab it on the OD of the material, and start whittling away towards the gas block. Then you're going to flip it, grab on a machine surface that is not perfect to the ID because you didn't control the ID of the OD at all, and then start machining down the other side till you get a barrel. But your OD is not perfect to your ID because you didn't run it on centers. So what we do is we built a profiling machine that's just profile barrels. It doesn't do anything else. We grab it on cones that we stick in the hole that we just gun drilled. We have a 3-jaw self-centering chuck that pulls it back into that cone, and it holds it perfectly on the ID. Now we remove the OD so that it is perfect with the ID. And with our steady rest that we can move in the machine on our turret in the bottom, we can put a steady rest anywhere. And we do everything from the 980 dimension on the back chamber all the way up to the threads and the crown in one operation. So the whole, everything is done in one holding. Because we can come back in and grab it with a steady rest, release that, you know, other center, thread, crown, and control the whole muzzle brake end. It comes out. We stick it in another lathe. We grab it on the 980 dimension. We have a custom-built robotic end piece, and that end piece moves for overall length and controls overall length. So it's an automatic stop. So the robot will say, hey, I'm bringing a 10.5 inch, I'm bringing a 13.7, I'm bringing a 14.5, I'm bringing a 16 inch. and we have to automatically move that stop so that we control our overall lengths for all those datums and everything else. So it'll push against that automatic stop. The chuck will grab it. We will then get the robot out. We'll open the chuck again, and with a turret, we have a spring that will then shove that barrel against that stop again. We will re-grab it on that 980 dimension. Then we will go machine our threads and our chambers and that kind of stuff.
And what's that time frame on that process? You said, I think you said it earlier, but
it's like 3 minutes. So it's 3 minutes. We have two profiling machines and one chamber machine. So the chamber machine runs the tack time. So I think it's like 3 minutes. But we have a custom steady. We have a custom stop. But the chamber machine also runs oil. So we're running. We got a chiller. We're chilling the oil. We don't want fires. Right? You got to keep things. But this thing has been custom built to chamber a barrel. We didn't go buy a Haas lathe, put coolant in it, and chamber stuff, right? This is a custom-built, fully automated cell that whisker checks for tool breakage. It automatically checks for this. It checks rotational force of the tools. It guarantees that the oil's at 58 degrees and not at 109 and ready to spark and blow up. It makes sure, and with oil through the back of that stop that sets overall length, we run 1,000 PSI oil through the barrel so that when we're chambering, we're not recutting a chip twice. So by doing all of those little crazy things, you have a stupidly stable process. We can hold chamber depth and all that and headspace within a tenth.
And I know you can't really list the companies by name that you're doing that for, but how many companies, give or take?
So on an ATF variance, I think we have 200 variances on file right now. Out there now.
Wow.
They're not all active, right? Yep. Not everybody orders every month.
Is that different like models and stuff, or is that different companies?
It's just different companies. So if there's an 07 manufacturer and an 07 manufacturer doing variance work and they want their name on a lower receiver,
right?
You do a Department of Justice variance.
Yep.
And we can put Big Tech's ordinance on a lower receiver for you without you having to buy a machine and own it, right? So the best hidden secret in the gun industry is that everybody makes their own stuff. You know, everybody makes their own stuff.
Like I've always taken the position that it's better to let the machine shops be the machine shops and let the gun companies, you know, focus on their QC and their design and everything. Cause like, I mean, what would it cost? Like if somebody wanted to go out and replicate what that is, like what DRG or Outer Wild is, like how, like time, money, resource, like what would it take to go replicate what y'all are doing?
So the main shop's in 35,000 square feet, and then the assembly and kitting shop down the street's about 15,000 feet, I think. That's just square feet, right? Yeah. I would say that it would take 30 good guys and about $30 million, and it would probably take you 3 years to get it fully running and good. If you said I'm gonna copy everything they did today, right? We built it over 5 or 6 years, but we built $1.5 to $2 million automated cell every year. And just, hey, we have a cell that runs 10,000 carriers a month, fully robotic, and I'll sit there at Thanksgiving dinner and watch the camera. And Fred's running, you know? It gets bad for Employee of the Month when the robot wins every month. But,
you know? Are the robots named or numbered?
Everybody has different names for different robots. We have Sir Lancelot. There's a couple other ones. The robot comes down and he's got a 16-inch barrel sticking out of it, and, you know, and he's just grabbing it by the puck at the end or where it's going to be chambered to that. So it's, you know, sticking out 16 inches and he runs down a 30-foot rail or, you know, I think it's a 80-foot rail between the three machines and that kind of stuff. So it looks like he's, Sir Lancelot.
That's awesome.
Jousting.
But on your point, dude, like for a gun company to go from like concept to finished product, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, I don't think anybody's making 100% of their parts in house.
No.
I mean,
even springs, like, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the one company we can obviously say, look at SIG. They're a machine shop with a gun problem. Yeah. They don't make all their own stuff in house. Yeah. They can't. And I think SIG's got, what, 18 machine shops themselves around the country for their different stuff and everything? And,
like, I can get the desire to want to be vertically integrated and all that, but, like, at a certain point, like, it's just not feasible.
No. A spring comes off every half second. Go buy it from the spring guy. Buy 10,000, 100,000 at a time and pay
they're making
13 cents.
Million a day or whatever it is. Like,
yeah. And how to run an old school cammed, like, they wire EDM and cut all the cams to make the spring turn because it's not servo driven. It's not computer driven right now. It's all cam stuff. I know a couple spring companies that they will go buy 80 old spring machines just because they need the parts. And they store them because they can't get the parts anymore. Huh. And the new, like, true rotary servo-driven crazy spring machines are just so expensive. Hmm. But on a lot of the stuff we do, we take that extra step. And I can tell you why a lot of the other companies don't. We make 10,000 bulk carrier groups a month. I put $7 extra into every bulk carrier group for grinding and certain things. If I want 70 grand a month back, I know right where to get it. It still makes an acceptable product. I meet the mil-spec print, but it's not what we want as our standards.
So it's that little extra that you're putting into.
Oh, the assembly guys love it. I mean, being able to get ground, you know, our cam pins. We mill the top of the cam pin and then we, you know, turn the barrel of the shaft, but we turn it oversized. We're not trying to hold a tenth or two tenths or three tenths on a Swiss machine, right? It's going to grow 6 tenths in heat treat. So we run it 2 thou, 3 thou over, kick them out real quick on a Swiss machine, bring it out, heat treat it, send it back to the grind shop and let them go send all those grind it down to 310 perfectly to the print, you know? Why fight in the manufacturing process of things that you can cheaply fix afterwards?
And that grind process, that's automated as well?
No. There's certain things that, like a cam pin, it's a through feed. So they just line them up on a feed and it runs them through and self-centers it and feeds it. So, but it gets it to the perfect size every time. And we hold it within a tenth. You know, your hair is 4 thou thick. So if you want to talk about tenths and sizes, and a piece of paper is 4 thousandths thick. So we're arguing over crazy tolerances. But we do it for our pivot pins too. Our pivot and takedown pins, they're all ground. They're all 250. They're not 250 and a half. They're not 249 and a quarter. They're 250. Because reaming the holes, drilling the holes, and then working on the tolerance stack. I mean, you guys hear about tolerance stack all the time where you can put a credit card through the upper and lower of a gun, you know? Oh, it's mil-spec. Yeah, that's mil-spec.
Yeah.
They're within their tolerance stack. But ours, we want to make sure that 250 dimension from the holes to the flat of the upper, the flat of the lower, that kind of stuff is perfect. So keeping holes on the high side of the tolerance before anno, within spec on the high side, and then keeping pins on the medium to low side allows quick assembly.
How much does... I actually had this conversation with a guy you know last night when he was here. How much thickness does anodizing add when you anno a part?
That the industry uses or true mil-spec anodizing?
Either.
It's going to be anywhere... And so... Let's talk in thickness and then thickness per side. So on a pivot pin area back there, there's two lugs and you have per side there, right? You have two sides. So anywhere from on a 70-75 T6, 6/10 to 1.8 thou. And then you will get anodizing works two ways, in and out. Okay? So anodizing goes in and it goes out. Mattering the anodizer, mattering the chillers, and mattering how they run their baths and how clean and at what temperatures and chemical balance and all that kind of stuff. The perfect world is a thou in and a thou out. So you get two thou for true mil-spec anodizing. Cerakote guys hate it because it's not coming off in sandblast.
Yeah.
Right? If you take 80 grit or 120 grit, 40 PSI sandblast, and the stuff comes right off, it wasn't true mil-spec anodizing. The problem is a lot of the anodizers are run like 70-30. It'll go 70% in, 30% out because of the way they run their baths, their chillers, and that kind of stuff. The chillers are the most expensive part for anodizing to run. So, and if you don't hold the anodizer to growth and thickness out versus in, it matters where you get. So if you get anodizing where it like flakes, it's all in. It's very little out. Or they're at the wrong temperature, they burned it. So if you want to talk about 50 Shades of Gray and 50 Shades of
Want to get in colors, man.
So it's 60-61 handguards versus a 70-75 upper and a forging and a billet 70-75 lower versus a 60-61 upper versus, you know, there's probably two anodized shops in the country that can match 60-61 to 70-75. Period. It's that crazy. And how you clean it, how you sandblast it, and how you prep it matter almost as much as what they do in the bath and where the metal came from.
And that's why during COVID, everything was fucked up.
So the Russians run terrible aluminum. The Chinese are getting better at running better, terrible aluminum. America makes the best metal possible. Germany makes the best gun barrel metal possible. Italy makes the best stainless steel, period. So using DFAR countries that allow you to buy material that are still DFAR compliant for military applications and that stuff, try and buy American-made stainless. You can't. It's all made in Italy.
That's crazy.
So Vector Industries.
Yep.
Let's talk about them a little bit. Kind of what's the theory behind that and how'd y'all get started with that and tell us what's going on over there.
So after building the crazy parts supplier and doing all that, I sold that in March to my sisters. They're running it. They're doing that. And we've done the parts thing. And, you know, kind of the holy grail is building out a really cool weapons platform and a weapons system and building a brand for it. I'm really glad I didn't know what I know today when I agreed to do it back then. Again, listening to the podcast and stuff, some of the other gun manufacturers on here have said, yeah, we sell parts because cash flow and, you know, you don't need 500 or 72 different things to assemble the gun. And if you're missing the crush washer, you ain't shipping the gun, right? Yeah, the parts world's great. Doing the full complete rifle thing, it's got 8 patents on it. It's pretty revolutionary for a short stroke piston system. I've known Paul Etner Wise for about 7 years. Paul is a great engineer and probably one of the, you know, Piston Daddies owning the Letner Wise Rifle Company, LWRC, and that kind of stuff, and creating that piston system. He's had 20 years to you know, develop a new one and really learn and really dive into the craziness of certain things and the way that his engineering brain works. I mean, he's figured out a new piston system. And so being able to license his piston system and that kind of stuff and taking our manufacturing prowess to it. And then now I own the patent on the fully ambidextrous lower receiver that we bought MVB Industries out of Florida and shut it down and liquidated the machine shop because the last thing I need is another machine shop in Florida.
And they were halfway across the country trying to manage that.
Yeah, no, they were going through some stuff and some buddies owned it and they called me up one day and they're like, you're buying this today. I was like, fine. So we bought that. We got a couple of their patents and honestly, their patented lower receiver just seems to be like the most intuitive. It takes everybody like one or two times to like figure it out. And like once the brain clicks, it's like clay pigeon shooting. Once the
yeah, like the bolt catch, I was playing around with it. I was like, oh man, it's release only. And then I think it was Justin was like, no, push it all the way. I'm like, oh, sweet.
Yeah. So to hold back and release, it's kind of feels like a two stage trigger.
Yeah.
There's some slop and some give, and then you really push it in and it works. We did it on purpose and we adjusted their system slightly to how we wanted it. Because if you're a lefty and it hits your plate carrier, I don't want you dropping a mag. If it's on your righty and that kind of stuff, you never have to give up your grip anymore. You can stay on your red dot. You can stay on your sight. You can do everything with your grip intact. So from talking to the guys that actually, you know, do this for a living and are cool operator type guys that I'm not giving up your grip and being able to do certain things while controlling your trigger and that kind of stuff. It's like they explain it as that's my life. So being able to load a mag, drop it and reach out onto your rail without having to palm, thumb, or any of the other kind of techniques that right-handers do to release the bolt again is awesome.
Yeah, it's definitely set up well. We did a video earlier today that will actually probably air on our YouTube channel prior to the podcast coming out, but we're going to get the rifle and take it over to the range here probably tomorrow and get some video on it. And I'm looking forward to shooting it. It feels very, very nice.
Yeah. We were messing around with them yesterday afternoon when they landed.
Yeah.
There in the so back. Like a 16 inches, 6.8 pounds. So that's a short stroke, fully ambidextrous, full rifle at 6.8 pounds. I mean, the competition's at like 13 pounds and everyone complains that it's a brick.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, that's a problem. I, you know, as a recovering fat kid, I don't want to carry that stuff around. Yep. I'm down 57 pounds, and I enjoy not having 57 pounds on my knees and my body and my ankles and everything else right now, you know, right?
Yeah.
So if I can get rid of 6 pounds in a gun, that's huge.
Yeah, usually you pick up a piston AR, and you're like, wow, this thing's a boat anchor. Really fork, you know, really barrel heavy. Mm-hmm. Not balanced very well. This one's pretty legit.
And where this is self-regulating and truly self-regulating, it's not adjustable. You don't have to adjust the gas block. You don't have to think what number you're on. You don't have to do any of that. With the three holes on the one-piece op rod function the gun. Then when it strokes out and the other three holes come in, so there's 6 holes on that op rod. So when those other 3 holes open, you have all 6 holes open, it's dumping gas. So mid-stroke now, you can dump gas where no other system on the planet can do that.
Because it's got enough that to function.
It's functioned already.
And it's just getting rid of excess.
After function, what happens? Reset. If you're still functioning past function, then you're not resetting. So we want to get back to reset as fast as possible. So, and then with the long advanced cam path that we kind of, you know, Paul came up with and kind of fixed out, being able to fix Stoner's, you know, inherent problem. So the AR-10 came out in, what, 55? The Air 10 came first for 55, and then in like 57, and someone's going to fact check me and I'll be close. And in 57, when the Air 15 came out, they modified the normal AR 10 cam path. So on an AR 10, the cam pin doesn't hit the upper receiver. But on an AR 15, if you, in CAD, in theory, if you overlay the two cam paths, you can truly really see, and I can send you a picture. You can see where the AR 15 cam path is the same as an AR 10, just slightly smaller and modified for a smaller cam pin. Mm-hmm. Stoner wanted 22.5 degrees. So top dead center on a gun is 22.5 degrees to where the cam pin goes back and forth and doesn't hit. But what the cam pin controls is obviously the lugs on the bolt. So on a normal AR, you'll feel the lugs kind of kiss the lugs on the extension as you go to open that first inch a little bit. But you'll also feel your cam pin hit your upper until you clearance your upper. The metal cam pin will make a groove and a line in your upper receiver.
Oh yeah.
So that didn't sit well with Paul for a while, and he had, you know, uppers from Colt, and he had uppers from way back in the day, and threw it all. And even today, go buy any gun you want that runs a normal Stoner cam path, and you're going to have an upper with a line in it. Mm-hmm. But you're also going to nick your lugs every single time it opens. So Paul engineered and Paul figured out that it goes to get it to 22.5 degrees. They had to elongate the cam path and truly get it to 22.5 degrees. Getting that 2 extra degrees of closing gave us a really cool unintended consequence that worked out well. We got that 2 degrees of dwell. And what we've been able to figure out is in that 2 degrees of dwell where we stay locked up 2 degrees longer, we dump about 15 to 20,000 PSI out of the system before it operates. We run a carbine buffer and a carbine spring. If you buy a complete upper from Vector Industries, you get a carbine buffer and a carbine spring in the box. We want to give you the system. Because consistency and systems matter. You don't need an H2. You don't need an H3. You don't need a spring coat red spring. You don't need an A5 system. You don't need all the things that they give you to fix what they tried to do up front, right? So with that 2 degrees more of dwell and dumping that much pressure off of, the gun operates at such a lower PSI and operating pressure that it's just stupidly smooth. So a couple weeks ago, we were able to go to TriggerCon, really launch the gun brand commercially, and really show the people the difference. And we had 4 guns on the line. We shot 4,000 or 5,000 rounds that day. 0 failures, 0 problems, and oiled them. Never really cleaned them, right? Piston systems run cleaner because there's not a lot of gas in. And with this really being able to self-regulate and operate at a lower pressure, we're seeing under 1/4 inch on a red dot move. So your 2nd, 3rd, and 4th shot are right there. We had one of the Rainier Arms Firearms Academy instructors, 10.5 inch with a Huxworks flow on it, dump 18 rounds into a fist size group.
Oh, wow.
10 yards. And he's like, I can't do that with my gun today because they're moving, they're kicking. There's, you know, I think here, especially you guys on the part side, how many recoil management devices do you sell?
Oh yeah.
And you know, the gun manufacturers are right. They overgas the barrel so that on a regular DI gun, they overgas it. So no matter what cheap ammo you bought down the street at the range that day or at Academy or anything else, they don't get the phone call that it doesn't function.
Yeah.
Because no other system can mid-stroke dump gas. Being able to dump overpressure and not put it into your shoulder is a game changer. So we're excited for you guys to shoot them later.
Yeah. No, it's cool hearing all the stuff behind it. This is pretty fascinating.
Why'd you go piston?
Every gun the military is looking at, every gun that the military has bought, every gun that overseas contracts are looking for, everything is going piston. So every big contract, every big award, every big purchase in the last 2-3 years is piston. And what else? I mean, on a DI gun, what can I give you?
Yeah, last thing we need is another DI gun. There's everyone's making a DI gun.
You get a choice. I can give you a DI gun for $350 and race at the bottom with everybody else, and we can discuss spring pressures and buffer weights and adjustable gas blocks that every time you turn it down, it raises the pressure in the system and that kind of stuff. So now you got to fix the pressure raise. So I can tell you this: whatever gas hole you drill in the barrel, the gas is coming out of that hole. If you have a 16-inch barrel, you lock a bolt on one end, you pull a trigger, you have a bullet traveling down a barrel. When that bullet passes your gas hole and is a little bit past that, you have a pipe bomb. You're sealed on both ends. Where are you expecting the gas to go? Your gas block isn't bleeding. You have good seal. It's going through that hole. Now you can slow down your cyclic rate with an H2 or an H3. You can get a bigger spring. You can put an adjustable gas block up top. But once you try to limit gas flow after you've already created the flow, you're raising pressure. Go stick your thumb over a hose. You're not stopping the water from coming out. It's coming. Now you have to manage what you did.
Yeah.
So on a solid tube of a gas tube, there's only certain ways to manage it. And more force and pressure on a spring or a buffer or weight or that kind of stuff will give you that little bit of time you need to wait for the bullet to get out of the barrel and open up another hole for gas to vent. Or when your bolt carrier group opens and you have a heavy back pressure cannon, when that bolt carrier group opens, you're dumping that gas back into your face, back into your eyes, back into your mouth, back into your upper receiver and caking your stuff full of that. So how are we fixing any of that? You have to go piston.
Yeah. Yeah, I think with all the, you know, the flow through cans and the switching to pistons, and there's a lot of that has to do with, you know, the adverse health risk that we've been seeing.
Anybody a left-hander?
Oh, yeah.
You're left-handed, right?
No, I'm righty.
Oh, okay.
But I'm just saying, so like we were given a demo to a PD the other day. They're running 11.5-inch Colt Commando Sporters, I think they are, from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
With a can this long on it. And that poor lefty, I mean, the gun's doing this every time. And that poor lefty's just sucking gas. And we told him in the room, we're like, shoot my 10.5 with a Hux Flow on it. You're not smelling gas, let alone sucking it, you know? And he looked at me and he's like, bullshit. It's like, let's go to the range. So we jumped in the trucks, went down to the range. They dumped 200 rounds through three guns, no gas. And if you've ever shot a gun and suppressed and eaten gas in the face and lived and that kind of stuff, it's terrible. So if this is another thing for health reasons, 100%, to not, you know, have to sit there and cough and black lung. And I mean, how many times have you cleaned your nose out after a good range day and it's black?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's not healthy.
Yeah, it's not recommended.
On that note, if you end up switching that PD out, let us know. We'll take those uppers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, straight up.
I got to find somebody who wants the machine gun lowers, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's always neat, finding some old stuff like that. It's always popular.
Oh, they had some great carry handle stuff in there, too.
It was man.
What are you? They're like, we know. It's like, all right, we'll give you a trade-in number.
For real.
But for like the flow through technologies, and if you're a decibel queen and you're going to argue over 4 or 5 decibels, and you'd rather eat gas in the face for 4 or 5 decibels or that kind of stuff or whatever the number is between.
Yeah, the decibel people, they get under my skin so much. Like, I can understand, like, if you're looking at for recreation or for hunting or whatever, like, I can understand nerding out over decibels. But, like, if you're looking for, like, a serious use weapon system, the decibels should be the last thing you're worried about. Like, there's, like, return to zero, you know, durability, signature reduction, you know, pressure, gas out the back. Like, yeah. There's so many other variables, but people like to nerd out on decibels for some reason.
And if you're a SWAT team in a house, you're wearing a comm system or something anyways. You're wearing muffs.
Well, what's the difference between 145 and 138 decibels? It's still loud as fuck, and it's still going to damage your hearing.
Yeah, it's still not hearing safe.
You're nerding out over stuff that doesn't even matter.
No, but like, if you're out hunting and you're going to take 2 shots that day, I don't care about 7 decibels. I care about lightweight maneuverability and you know, not having a brick on the end of my gun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, especially if you're rucking over the mountains or something, or, you know, 7 miles.
And as much cool things as we can do in a machine shop, a 3D printer is nuts. For gas flow and the way they can, I mean, you can print titanium on Inconel inside of ceramic next to a stainless steel core, you know?
So cool.
And it's all monolithic, and it's all one piece, and it's, I can almost guarantee in 5 years or 3 years or some short period of time, no one's ever machining a suppressor again.
I believe that.
Yeah.
Kids, it's over. I mean, it's not as good as the replicator on Star Trek. And that's coming
from a machine shop guy. Like,
you're not.
Like,
yeah. It's. Why do I want to machine it, laser weld it, regular weld it, buff it? No. 3D print the thing. The way you can move gas in those mini turbines and that kind of stuff inside that, there's been some really crazy things we've seen and heard where, I mean, if you want to talk about like dry filmed buffer tubes and why Vector uses dry filmed buffer tubes on everything just to get that rattle of the spring out.
Oh, yeah.
I hate that rattle. But you hear the bolt move and you hear the rattle of the spring before you ever hear the gun on some of the new suppressors that people are coming out with. And especially if you eliminate gas and do gas blocks off and that kind of thing where it's single shot, it's the way they can, I mean, they can basically make a brick with tubes in it, and it's just like a Borg cube, but with tubes and vents and everything inside and all that kind of stuff, and you don't hear anything.
That's cool. I know I'm pretty excited about the new Huxworks can. They're coming by on Wednesday.
Oh, nice.
And we're going to do some stuff with them.
Oh, the Ventum?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome.
That's pretty cool.
We were able to get a pre, we were under, you know, non-disclosure and that kind of stuff to get a pre-release one.
Nice.
And it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. They've done some cool stuff with that. I'm looking forward to getting a deep dive on that with them on that can. So we know, I'm fixed to ask you if you've got anything cool coming up, but you are in the process of cool coming up. You've got Vector Industries. You've got your full commercial launch of the rifle.
Yeah. So available on Big Techs, available at the range, available on that kind of stuff right now.
We have a demo gun there at the range.
Yep.
It's going to have a Huxworks can on it.
It's going to have – we don't have a Huxworks actually.
Oh.
For it. Because I got the – I messed that one up. We got the 13.7. So they didn't have the 13.7 muzzle device yet.
Oh, gotcha.
So okay. Yeah, I think by the time this airs, the Huxworks 13.7 will be announced. when we pin and welded our first batch of 13.7 barrels, we used the Sons of Liberty Gun Works Nox.
Oh, the Nox. Okay.
Because it's awesome, and if you want a 13.7 gun, you have to, you know, use certain muzzle brakes, and Surefires are
a little too short.
And back pressure.
Yeah.
So we'll be offering both the Huxworks and the Nox going forward.
Well, the Nox is incredibly popular in like the chemo. There's so many suppressors out there. Like, Yeah. I mean, we got three suppressors in the rental case over there that'll take the chemo. Probably more. Probably like.
And with the new Ventum now, you can put an adapter on it. It's that 1.3 inch kind of universal mount. You can put an adapter on it and run a chemo.
Yep.
Oh. Yep.
So.
I don't think I've seen that.
It's in the truck. I'll bring it in.
Nice. Yeah, it's pretty cool. So we're going to have it over at the range. So if you're listening to this podcast and you're local, you could come actually rent it and shoot it and see what is up. And this will actually air after the big event this weekend.
Yep.
But you'll be there.
We'll be back.
Yeah.
Got to go to Louisiana a little bit, do some meetings there, come back.
Yeah.
But we'll be back. We'll have the tent out. We'll be vending. We'll have three or four guns on the line you can play with and see. Still haven't cleaned them. So
it's overrated. And you got your bolt carrier group. Talk a little bit about your bolt carrier group for DI guns.
So we have a DI version and we have a piston version. So the piston version and the DI version both have the padded cam path in them.
Okay.
And then it comes with our padded cam pin with the arrow in it. So on the top of our cam pin, we have an arrow. That's the patent on it for that. And then we want consistency. So we want the cam pin to go back in the same way every time. We want the wear grooves. We want everything else to line up perfectly so that your lockup is the same every time. So every time it locks up the same, accuracy. Consistency equals accuracy and that kind of stuff. But the DI bolt carrier group is in production right now. The piston bolt carrier group is in stock and available to ship and all that kind of stuff. And if you have a 416 or an LWRC or any other type of Adams Arms or that kind of stuff where you have another piston gun, it's a direct replacement and you get some of that back pressure reduction and you get that dwell built into it. So if your gun's shooting at 1 o'clock right now, you'll throw our bulk carrier group in, it'll nicely shoot at 3 o'clock. So it regulates and helps with the gas pressures and that kind of stuff on a normal system.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool little bolt.
Yeah, thin dense chrome, covered, kind of cool little way we do it. It's 2/10. It can't flake. It can't do all the things that people hate Nib-X for or fake Nib-X and not, WMDs at Nib-X is probably the best, but it can't flake. It can't do that kind of stuff. So, and again, all ground on the inside. Even for the piston one, we grind the three IDs even though there's no gas, right? We still want smoothness of operation and smoothness of everything moving. So getting it down to that really glass surface is good.
Justin, you got any questions after this?
I did have one question for you. So, with the DI gun, the gas tube is a cheap maintenance item, right? You replace it if it gets blown out or whatever the case. Do you take the same approach with the piston? I'm not very familiar with piston guns. Do you take the same approach? Or is it more of a thoroughly engineered
built? No, it's not a really a wear item. So we have a gas block. Inside the gas block, we insert a gas nozzle. The gas nozzle, we grind the OD and we grind not really like razor blades, but kind of carbon cutters kind of things into them. Mm-hmm. So every time, and then it's a spoon and cup type thing, so is kind of what it's called in the old school piston systems or spoon and cups. So the gas nozzle is the male part and the op rod is the female part that slides over it. So with those ridges and the way we cut it, we create a gas seal also in those little chambers between the grooves, and we grind the ID of our op rod to make sure that our tolerancing is perfect between the two. And it's a one piece solid op rod that's fluted on the long part. And then it's fully supported by a spring cup that's on the barrel nut. So we don't put a insert in the back of the upper or anything like that. It's truly free floating. And then our handguard holds that spring cup and the barrel nut.
Gotcha.
So everyone's like, well, can I change this? Can I move this? Can I do this? Can I put a different rail on it? It's like, no, but you get M-locks now, and you get 9 inches of M-locks or 12.6 inches of M-locks or 15 inches of M-locks and, 9, 3, and 12, and next, or 3, 6, and 9. and we get a Picatinny rail up top. The handguard is part of the system.
Yep.
Gotcha.
So there's 8 pens on the gun, and we really, there's a heavy duty buffer retainer in the back for a Gen 2 buffer retainer that holds the carbine spring and buffer in and all that kind of stuff. And really, we went through and really fixed every complaint of piston and DI guns. Piston guns are too heavy. Well, we're 6.8 pounds. You know, 13.7, 6.7 pounds, you know? I think the 10.5 inches, like 6.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And guns. Since they operate at such a lower operating pressure, they don't really kick or move. And people call bullshit until they shoot. And then they're like, all right, I listened to your bullshit speech before, and you kind of give me that. But what'd you do? You know? Most of the guys will shoot 3 to 4 rounds through it, put it on safe, kind of turn it sideways, look at it, go, what is this? Put it back on fire, dump 6 to 8 more rounds through it, and then be like, all right, I kind of listened to you before, and I don't remember what you said. Walk me through it again. Yeah. What'd you do? Because by changing those incremental things, it really, really makes a difference.
We're definitely looking forward to it. And you can find, if you're listening to this podcast, you can find the Vector Rifles on BigTexOrdnance.com. If you're a dealer, you can also find those rifles on BTODealer.com. We'll have your small parts available soon.
Both dealer and...
If somehow you're listening to this podcast before the vendor day... you should show up to the vendor day. If you're listening to this podcast, you missed it, buddy.
Yeah.
But the rifle.
But yeah. Vector needs help from BTO. We need some t-shirt swag. You know, we got to figure out how to make some t-shirts together because you guys are on point with the swag, the t-shirts, and the candy.
We've already came up with I think I've got my first sticker idea for this from our conversation. For the slaps. Yeah, for some slaps for this.
Oh, nice.
So I'll get Max on some slaps for this.
It's already
for
cooking. Sure.
We ordered some Kratos Design QD mounts for the demo guns and everything before TriggerCon, and I love that they're made out of steel.
Yeah.
I love that they're hardcore use, and they fit perfectly in a perfectly milled M-lock slot.
Yeah, they do.
And they're easy to install, and I love that the QD doesn't rotate in there freely.
Yep. Yeah. It's a.
So.
Some thought went into that.
Yeah. A little bit of thought.
Somebody woke up at 2 a.m. going, oh God. I keep a notepad next to my bed.
Yeah.
Because if I don't write it down and I don't do that, I can't go back to sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. That's been my trick is like, I'll come up with something. I'll send myself an email from my phone, write it down right then.
Yep.
Otherwise, like, I'll just be thinking about it and it'll be like 3 hours and it's like 4 a.m. now. And I'm like, fuck.
What was that? What? How did I want that set up?
I know. And if you don't write it down, the brain doesn't know that you like saved it. It's like, you're not going to bed.
Yep. No, it's like, you're up now.
You're up now.
Yeah.
But if you've listened to this podcast to this point, we really appreciate it. If you're watching on YouTube, drop a comment. Let us know what you liked about the podcast. Or if you've got a question for Dave or any of the crew here, let us know on the comment section below. And if you're listening to us on an Apple device, please leave a review of some sort. You can just be like, it sucks, but it's a review, so Apple will like it. Anyway,
5 stars.
It's got to be five stars. But dude, thanks again. We can't make another 2 year.
No, I mean, all the other stuff, we got to definitely get together, drink some good whiskey and smoke some cigars and see each other
for
more.
Sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
So I really appreciate you guys taking a risk on a new company with some innovative stuff. And I appreciate having us out.
Dude, we like supporting our friends. That's one of the best things about this job.
Yeah.
I think so. That was an easy decision.
Yeah.
For sure.
I'm planning on putting 100,000 miles on the truck, so let's do this.
Yeah.
Awesome, man.
You're on your way.
Yeah. Making a good start.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you for listening and watching. Y'all have a great day, night, whatever.
Whatever.
Morning. Stay strapped.
Get clapped.
Wait, that's not how it is. Anyway.